Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We at RMA looked at ways to improve and expand insurance options with the weaned calf.
Marcia Bunger, administrator of the Risk Management Agency, on a new pilot program for weaned calf protection.
We have a number of other livestock products that we've seen a tremendous amount of growth with utilization of those products. But then again, we have not in the past had really a product for the cow-calf producer. And so through the 508H process, we have now been able to announce and roll out weaned calf. So it is only in 4 states, and you know, we want to make sure that we get it right. And so that's why it's being piloted in a limited area. But I certainly hope that there is some interest and at least some initiative to take a look and learn more about it, even if you don't decide to buy it this year.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's always concerns, but we've had a long period of smooth sailing when people said we would be in a recession by now. So we've certainly disproved those claims big time if you look at the current economy.
Dr. Jared Bernstein is director of the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
I mean, 2023, 2.7 million jobs. That is a big jobs number for the year. Over 14 million jobs since President Biden took office. And look, this kind of news keeps coming, and it's not an accident. If you have a strong labor market, easing inflation, two things we've seen in 23 as we head into 24, that means real pay is starting to grow. So paychecks, wages are beating prices now for many workers. That wasn't the case a year ago. And that's really important because that gives some wind in the sail of consumer spending, which has been quite strong. We just got a great retail sales report for December. We're also seeing consumer sentiment start to pick up. We got a great report today, a couple months in a row now, where we're seeing people's these positive trends starting to reach people's feelings about the economy in a way that they haven't before. So we're on a pretty positive path. There are always risks to the forecast, as you know as well as anybody, but I like where we are.
He says one positive is the unemployment rate.
The unemployment rate has been below 4% for just about 2 years running. And I know many of our listeners are thinking about rural economies. We looked at the rural unemployment rate. It's actually about the lowest on record. It's somewhere around 3.5%, 3.6%, which is about where the overall national average is. And rural tends to run a little cooler than that. So the fact that we've had great labor markets, job growth in rural America has been a good thing to see. Now, this story I just told you, this dynamic about where we have a strong labor market supporting strong consumer spending with inflation coming down and even some prices coming down, we expect that to continue. One reason is because we're trying to make that happen at the White House. President Biden recently talked about getting rid of or at least cutting in half excessive overdraft fees that banks charge. We're going after all the junk fees we can. We've aggressively lowered the cost of prescription drugs, whether it's insulin, cost of health coverage, putting a cap on drug expenditures for folks on Medicare. All of that helps reduce inflation as well as even reducing prices directly. So all of those are in play, along with our investment agenda in areas of clean energy, chip production. And so we expect that momentum to carry us ahead this year.
Actually, when you look back at last year's report to the president, he says they kind of got it right.
Well, sometimes you get the forecast right and sometimes you don't. And I just want to be very transparent that I've been on both sides of that equation. But yeah, I think that one of the things that President Biden has really stressed in a way that we've listened to is we want to maintain the great job market while easing inflationary pressures, while taking down prices as best we can. And that's not an easy thing to do. Most economists told us if you're inflation, you're going to have to accept slower GDP growth and higher unemployment. And this is not okay with this president because he's coming at this as a kitchen table issue on families like the ones like the one he grew up in. And so meeting his, as we talked about, you know, a year ago in the report you mentioned, meeting the president's goals meant maintaining these dynamics while easing up on prices. And the fact that that's occurred has been, you know, very positive to see. But prices are still too high in lots of areas. You're never out of the woods in this business. So we really have to build on the progress we've made thus far.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Visiting with Dan Bossi, who gave his 2023 Agricultural Economy Report. That's here at the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention. So, Dan, what are some of the takeaways you wanted for the folks here?
Well, you know, we really wanted to, again, dial down onto what we call different things that are happening. You know, I don't want to get into the climate debate, if you will, but we know that climate is changing. And again, whether it's based on God or man, we'll leave up to somebody else. But as we look at it, there's some key droughts going on around the world that are very important. The Panama Canal being a real choke point right now, which is the lake that feeds the canal is low. We are not going to get more rain into that area. It's going to be a problem now till May. It's going to have a demonstrative effect on world ocean freight rates, which means the cost of shipping food globally is going to be rising. At the same standpoint, we're going to have this choke point for the U.S. Gulf. So it's going to be impacting, in particular, the grain and things that are the agricultural products coming out of the United States. So we're watching this very closely. Along with that, we've got a very unusual drought in northern Brazil. The Amazon, which is an area that is one of the wettest in the world, normally in places like December, January, they get anywhere from 12 to 17 inches of rain a month. And now we're looking at dryness that is drying up rivers and causing real ecological and farming damage. And so, well, we can't quantify it yet today, but December is a key month because soybeans are in the reproductive phase. So we'll give a better idea in late December, January. But those are some of the things we talked about weather-wise. Then we kind of migrated a little bit and talked about U.S. Farm policy, the U.S. opportunity, what maybe a Brazilian drought might mean with Safrina for the U.S. farmer, why we thought grain markets are now bottoming out, both wheat and corn, and really then looking forward to the upcoming year. We're optimistic of U.S. net farm income. We saw a rather significant $32 billion drop this year. I'm thinking year ahead it'll be either up or down a little bit, maybe $2 to $5 billion. But I really want to leave with everybody, volatility in ag markets is with us, and a lot of it's due to, of course, AI and the algorithms which now trade our markets. You know, 90%, if you will, of the trade in futures markets is non-human, and that just gives us more volatility because they all do the same thing at the same time, which exacerbates price movement.
I thought that was fascinating because the whole AI debate, discussion is all over the place. How about when it comes to fuel and having reserves here in the United States, and how long, what do we have? How much is left there with a lot of the policies that have been put in place of late? Where are we at there, and how's that affecting energy prices, and maybe some of the renewables as well?
Yeah, so at the moment anyway, the U.S. has about 16 days of energy reserves in its Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We call it the SPR. And so that is at the lowest level going back to the early 1980s. And so in a country the size of America, 16 days of fuel reserves is really not a reserve. It's a Band-Aid. And so if there ever is a problem and we're worried about the flares of the wars, if you will, and the flare-up potential in the Mideast, a choke point being, of course, the Suez Canal, this would be a big deal. So, you know, I think the Biden administration or future administrations, whoever's elected in 2024, needs to worry about the SPR and really start refilling it. Today would be a good time as energy prices are near $70 a barrel and trying to get back to maybe where we have as much as 60 days, not 16, in terms of energy supply reserves.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan, for visiting with me here. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm visiting with Bruce Knight, and Bruce, you moderated one of our panels here today, and it was very interesting. This was on the Climate Smart Ag Partnerships. Maybe the first thing to do would be to just define what those are.
Well, the Department of Agriculture announced a grant program about a year and a half ago. They awarded over $3 billion to 141 different partnerships that are in various ways trying to find ways to create market value associated with climate smart agriculture. Carbon sequestration, methane avoidance, nitrous oxide reductions in the atmosphere, any way that you could find a way to connect the dollars and cents of the marketplace to farmer actions. Most of these dollars are supposed to go on the ground. It's been in process for about a year now. Various projects slowly getting off the ground in 2023. I expect things to really take off now in the winter of 2024 with opportunities for farmers to sign up. In many of the Midwest states, if you're in Iowa or Illinois, you're going to have dozens of folks coming down your lane asking you to be involved in one of these projects. And it's going to be everything from cover crops to feed management and their cattle to all sorts of opportunities that encourage farmers to take a look at and find something that may make sense in their operation.
Yeah, and with ASTA, the cover crops is something that they're working on. And that's some interesting statistics about, you know, what is the percentage of farmers who are actually using cover crops. I knew it was small, but I didn't know it was quite as small as it is. But that's maybe because we've talked with a lot of farmers who are doing it. But what are some of the other things that we're hearing a whole lot about? It's kind of got the carbon word in it. It's mm-hmm. or sequestration of and in carbon markets even. Are those included in those types of work that's being done?
Yes, they are. So throughout commodity agriculture in the Midwest, a lot of opportunities are going to be out there on cover crops, which are obvious. Probably today about 8% of the acres have cover crops, so there's great opportunities for involvement. No-till, minimum till, transfer from conventional till to that is another carbon smart practice that's going to be used a lot. We're expecting new products to be coming in the market around feed additives that will be out there in very short order. So you're going to be able to add something to a cow's diet and reduce her enteric fermentation, the belching, by maybe as much as 20 to 30% without reducing milk or beef production. So there's a host of these things, some large 20% gain, others that are 3 or 5% gain, and all of this rolls up to be climate smart agriculture. What's excited about it is, for me as a lifelong conservationist, is many times it's traditional conservation practices. It's keep something green and growing, it's keep cover on the ground, minimize tillage, the stuff we've known for a long time, but now we're going to have the resources to take it at scale. You know, instead of having programs that only allow 40 acres of cover crops, you're going to be able to do 4,000. That's a big difference in a farm operation.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce, for taking time to visit here. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Thanks, Chuck. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
One area that we've been working with as an industry is to build out new markets for biodiesel and renewable diesel.
Kurt Kovarik is Vice President, Federal Affairs with the Clean Fuels Alliance America.
We all know that much of our fuel goes into on-highway, heavy-duty truck transportation primarily, but we've done a lot of work to build out what we call premium markets where pressures to decarbonize are significant and growing, and alternatives to petroleum are few. So marine is one that we'll touch on. Other areas that we've done a lot of work, obviously, are in home heating oil in the Northeast, railroads, as well as aviation. But marine has a specific hurdle to its adoption. That is the renewable fuel standard that was created by Congress 20 years ago explicitly excluded the fuel blended and sold into the marine market from being eligible for participation in the program. So if a biodiesel producer wants to sell to a cruise line, the credit that is associated with that gallon that they're given to comply with the renewable fuel standard does not apply. So we've got legislation that we've helped move along here in Congress. We've got a Republican from Iowa, a Marionette Miller Meeks, a Democrat from the San Francisco area, Mr. Garamendi, have introduced the bill back in December. And one thing that's kind of unconventional about this bill is that it's got geographic and bipartisan support. So we've got champions from California, Florida, and the Midwest, and we're seeking more. And what this bill would do is essentially remove that bit of red tape so that the financial incentive or the incentive to comply with the renewable fuel standard can stay attached to that gallon, even if it's blended in the marine sector. And I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we're focusing on markets where the pressure to decarbonize is real, but the alternatives to decarbonization and petroleum are few. So think of some of the largest ocean-going vessels. They're not going to electrify anytime soon. They're not going to find other ways to decarbonize. Our fuel, which is 75% less carbon emitting on average, can essentially be used, drop in to the fuel tank in these ocean-going vessels and immediately displace carbon.
Beginning this year, new UN regulations require existing maritime vessels to either meet a minimum energy efficiency design standard or be graded on carbon intensity.
The fact is that the ability to drop in the fuel today, next week, and have those carbon reduction emissions immediate is the real appeal to this fuel. And think about, you know, in Houston, the shipping area that you have there. We've got biodiesel producers along the Gulf Coast where this would be a great opportunity for them in their backyard to feed into this new market and deliver those carbon benefits, the economic benefits, the environmental benefits. So we're hopeful. You know, we're not naive about this. And, you know, when you have a Congress that has difficulty doing the basic functions of a Congress, keeping the government open and the lights on, for example, you know, we're not going into this too naive in terms of how quickly we get it done. This is a good starting point with this bill. We hope to have a Senate companion introduced here in the next couple of weeks. And then we're going to use the opportunity of our conference and other meetings that we're having here in Washington to try to line up additional support, get additional co-sponsors on that bill. And hopefully we can get it across the finish line here not too long.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have a problem of income inequality, nevertheless. I would argue what's more important is we have a educational inequality.
7 years ago, the former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, speaking at the Oxford Business School.
There was a story on the front page of the FT today, I think it was, that said there's nobody from the poor districts of London that comes to this great school, one of the great universities in the whole world, and zero from poor neighborhoods, at least that I assume the statistics are right and they didn't just cherry pick one neighborhood. So that is more important than net worth because that says what the future is going to be for the young people. Having said all of that, you can fix the inequality. You take money from the rich and you give it to the poor. We've always done that. We have a tax system generally around the world that is graduated at the top end. Progressive tax system takes more money from the rich per capita and redistributes it. Tuition in a university in America certainly is a Robin Hood plan. The kids are always on the wrong side of that. They always want lower tuition. No, you don't. You want to raise tuition in the university as high as you can so the wealthy will contribute more money and then use the extra money to subsidize those kids who have no money. If you reduce the amount of money you take in from the rich, it's the poor that get hurt, not helped. So some of these things are a little bit counterintuitive. But you take the money from the rich and you give it to the poor. You do it for altruistic reasons. You do it because you don't want the poor on your doorstep and a variety of things. But I think what you got to understand is the people who are getting the subsidy want the dignity of a job. They want the dignity of being responsible for their family and being able to take care of it. And that's the conundrum we're going to have here because technology is reducing the ability to give them the jobs. We're just more and more, if you think about it, the agrarian society lasted 3,000 years, and we could teach processes. I could teach anybody, even people in this room, so no offense intended, to be a farmer. It's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn. Then we had 300, you could learn that. Then you have 300 years of the industrial society. You put the piece of metal on the lathe, you turn the crank and the direction of the arrow, and you can have a job. And we created a lot of jobs. 98% of the world worked in agriculture. Today, it's 2% in the United States. Now comes the information economy. And the information economy is fundamentally different because it's built around replacing people with technology. And the skill sets that you have to learn are how to think and analyze. And that is a whole degree level different. You have to have a different skill set. You have to have a lot more gray matter. It's not clear the teachers can teach or the students can learn. And so the challenge for society to find jobs for these people who we can take care of, giving them a roof over their head and a meal in their stomach and a cell phone and a car and that sort of thing. But the thing that's the most important that will stop them from setting up the guillotine someday is the dignity of a job. And nobody's yet come up with a simple solution in this day and age to how we create jobs, particularly for people already out of school. I can tell you how to fix the school system so that the kids come out with better skills, and more ability to appreciate life and to work collaboratively and collectively and read the instruction manual and follow orders. But it's very hard to figure out where the jobs they're going to get will come from. And for those that are already out in the workforce, to get them back into the system and teach them new skill sets is almost impossible.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm visiting with Bruce Knight, and Bruce, we've certainly, over the last couple of years now, you know, soil health has been a real key word, if you will, that farmers are, or companies are being able to come out with new forms of nitrogen or whatever it might be. That seems to be a real growing area, along with biologicals as well.
Absolutely. And biological and soil health seem to be very closely linked. You know, many times these biologicals are actually triggering root growth or something in the soil that will either sequester more carbon or, more viable, would allow a plant to pull more nitrogen out of the air and for its own growth and its own use. It's really exciting ways in which we have the greening of entrepreneurship occurring right now. I mean, I see more startups doing everything from virtual fences for cows to biologicals that help the critters in the soil talk to the roots. Believe it or not, they do talk to each other, and each stimulates the other and grows more and results in greater yield in the corn. These are exciting times, and the entrepreneurship around climate smart agriculture is really exciting.
At this point, with these with the USDA climate smart projects, have they fulfilled their budget? Is that something that they're still, or companies able to maybe make a proposal?
These climate smart projects are really just getting started, but I see it not as a continual grant program. It's been kind of a one and done, a special thing that Secretary Vilsack was able to put in place at USDA. However, I do see an opportunity coming up within the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have something called a regional conservation partnership program that is opening the door in the same way for business, cooperatives, and farmers and NGOs in the conservation community to put in proposals about what they can do on traditional conservation as well as climate smart agriculture. That's going to open probably in January, February of next year, and it will be a large opportunity to continue to do these things. So collaborative partnerships in conservation work, and there's funding out there that's going to be available for them.
Anything else we didn't touch on there that you heard or might want to pass along from this panel that you had?
And the biggest thing here is that for a farmer, and I know most of your listeners are farmers, this winter, take a look under the hood of these programs when folks come to you. Some of the folks are, if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it probably is. But some of them are going to be worth a look. And especially if, as a farmer conservationist myself, I'm always looking for the things I would like to do on my ranch that I can't afford to do myself. If I can find a partner that will help pay for that, that's better for the environment, I want to take a look at that. And I know every farmer and rancher is in that situation. You're going to have opportunities this winter like you've never had before as a result of these and other grant opportunities out there. Know what you want to change. Know what you want to do on your farm. When those guys come knocking, ask them, will you help me on what I want to do instead of what you may want me to do?
Good point, good point. Well, thank you very much, Bruce, for taking time to visit here. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What I'm advocating for, and I think many members are, is a one-year extension that gets us through December of 24.
Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford.
That's not to say that we're not going to get farm bill done between now and then. What that means is we start the year knowing where we finish the year. That is to say we need to maintain some degree of continuity. And if we can do that with the current construct through a one-year extension, that I think will serve producers better, because we're going to start the year. You know, it won't be long before our producers are going back to the banks, and the banks are making those operating loans, and they're going to need to know, you know, that we're all singing from the same hymnal. So I think that's important to extend that out for a full year. That said, we will probably get the farm bill done and USDA reauthorized in the first quarter of 24, which would then supersede the extension. But what that means, though, is that at least we're providing a degree of certainty with a one-year extension.